a new Democratic candidate for governor. Thousands of fetal remains discovered at the home of a deceased former Indiana abortion doctor. Plus, auto workers on strike and more on Indiana Week in Review for the week ending September 20th, 2019.
Indiana Week in Review is made possible by the supporters of Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations and by Ice Miller. Built on a 100-plus-year foundation of legal service, Ice Miller is a full-service law firm committed to helping clients stay ahead of a changing world. Working to develop an understanding of each client's needs to help build, grow, and protect their interests. More at icemiller.com.
This week, Indianapolis Tech CEO Josh Owens, the state's first openly gay major party candidate for governor, announced his bid for the Democratic nomination. Josh Owens is the CEO of SupplyKick, an Indianapolis-based online retailer. The 34-year-old, who's never before run for elected office, announced he's filed for governor. Owens cites teacher pay, marijuana decriminalization, and strengthened gun regulations as key issues behind his run. Owens previously served as the chair of Indiana's Charter School Board, appointed by then-governor Mike Pence. The Indianapolis resident is the second Democrat to officially launch a bid to unseat incumbent Republican Eric Holcomb. Former State Health Commissioner Woody Myers announced his candidacy earlier this year. How appealing a candidate is Owens? It's the first question for our Indiana Week in Review panel. Democrat Ann Delaney, Republican Mike O'Brien, John Schwannis, host of Indiana Lawmakers, and Lindsay Erdody, state government reporter for the Indianapolis Business Journal. I'm Indiana Public Broadcasting State House reporter Brandon Smith. Mike O'Brien, how appealing is Owens to a statewide electorate?
I have no idea because he's never done this before and really run for anything before. But it is the season of having never done anything in politics and go do it at a high level. When I was county chairman in Hendricks County, it was during the early part of that was during the Tea Party era when people would kind of rolled off the couch and decided they wanted to be involved in politics and they call and go, "Hey, I'm running for Congress." I'm like, "Well, why don't we register you to vote?" And then we'll have you run for precinct committeeman, and then maybe if a town council seat opens, you can just kind of ease your way into this.
But some of that seems to have fallen away.
I don't think the Indiana electorate yet. I mean, I think he's a 34-year-old guy, right? So he's going to run on marijuana and these other issues. I think he's going to have a pretty, you know, he's going to have an audience for 20 and 30 somethings. But I don't think Indiana is. Become a little more progressive on those issues, a little more accepting of those issues, and certainly, I've been a supporter of an advocate for the LGBT community for a long time. So it's good to see openly gay candidates run for any office as well and continue making that more diverse. But I don't think the issues he ticked off, other than teacher pay, which should be a priority and a big conversation
in
2020. I'm not sure the rest of that's going to get much traction.
I want to actually ask, so he made teacher pay the top of his list, which seems like an avenue that a lot of Democrats are choosing to go after Eric Holcomb on. But he was also the head of Indiana's Charter School Board. Is that going to sit well with Democrats?
Appointed by Mike Pence.
Appointed by Mike Pence. Is that going to sit well with Democrats?
I mean, you can recognize the fact that teacher pay is substandard in Indiana and still be a proponent of charter schools. So, you've got that. I mean, it's not surprising that he wants to run. A lot of people are dissatisfied with the current administration's inability to deal with any of the big problems in Indiana. And as an openly gay person, I'm sure he's concerned based on what the Republicans do when they have supermajorities with things like RFRA. And Eric Holcomb was right in there without protesting about that. So,
it's... During RFRA.
It worked for Dan Coats to be pro-RFRA?
Eric worked for Dan Coats during RFRA.
Okay. And did he speak out against RFRA?
Why would he if he was working for a U.S. senator?
I see.
On a state legislative matter? Maybe because
he thought it was wrong. God forbid they should ever speak out about something because they think it's wrong.
I want to ask about the fact that he is openly gay. Obviously, that's not the political death knell it would have been 5-10 years ago, but... Is that still going to be a problem for him on a statewide election in Indiana?
I guess we'll find out. I mean, it'll be interesting to see. I agree with what you were saying, that it's definitely different now than it was a few years ago. I thought it was interesting when I talked to him about him running, and I brought it up and asked him about it. He seemed to kind of downplay the importance of it, and then when his press release went out announcing it, it was in the headline of it. And so... It'll be interesting to see how much of the campaign this has brought up And I also think, I mean, look at what Pete Buttigieg has done on the national level. And, you know, we don't hear him always talking about it, but we obviously know that he's gay and married. And
he has used it to some effect sparingly, like in targeted ways.
He doesn't shy away from it. It's definitely benefited him from, I mean, a lot of his money. I mean, that community has really supported him. Now, it's not reflected necessarily in getting him out of single digits, but it's a relevant and active community.
Sure, absolutely.
And
I also want to ask about his, well, let's ask about, it's kind of a dual issue. One, his age, and two, his lack of experience in politics, at least running for public office. Are those a benefit? Are those something that voters are going to say, well, we want somebody a little more seasoned?
Well, it seems in this political environment that being a novice and not being connected to any much-hated governmental entity or bureaucracy is a plus, at least theoretically. But let's look at it from a practical standpoint. You know, the parties, they may not be the kingmakers that they were a generation or two ago, but when you're running a statewide campaign, you need infrastructure, you need volunteers, you need expertise, you can't just, you know, if it were a small district, you know, you can kind of just, you know, you can't walk every street and knock on every door in the state of Indiana. So I wouldn't lessen the impact that the party organizations can have in a race like this. And it seems to me, if you look at history, and again, I'm reluctant to do that because everything I thought I knew about politics has sort of gone out the window in the last cycle or two. But it used to be either you had to earn your way, your stripes.
Like
exactly what Mike was talking about. You run for this, you run for that.
In fact, it's a liability if it's you're kind of in the driver, you know, in the
right,
the next guy up. I mean, that's kind of
well, or if you people have, want to impact change, and so they're like, well, why would I run for a local small office when I could run for governor?
The other way was sort of by birthright. I'll use Evan Bayh, and I don't mean that in a disparaging way, but you're sort of raised to be an office, or you've had tremendous success and you're known in households across the state for some endeavor in business or something. Josh Owens isn't any of those things. I mean, he's successful in his business by all accounts, but he's
not a household name.
So I just don't see.
Well, neither is Eric Holcomb.
I think he's a lot more household.
I think
to say it's an uphill.
He's got a 63% approval rating, 85% name ID.
Among the three people who know him.
Time now for viewer feedback. Each week we post an unscientific online poll question in conjunction with our Ice Miller email and text alerts. This week's question: who will be the Democratic nominee for governor in 2020? Woody Myers, Josh Owens, or someone else? And last week's related question: will Governor Eric Holcomb win re-election in 2020? 81% of you say yes, 19% say no. If you'd like to take part in the poll, go to wfyi.org/IWIR and look for the poll. Well, state legislators this week called for an investigation into a deceased former Indiana doctor after thousands of preserved fetal remains were discovered on his property in Illinois.
Ulrich Klopfer practiced and performed abortions at clinics in Indiana for years, but his license was suspended in 2016 in part because he failed to report in a timely manner abortions he performed on two girls under 14 years of age. Klopfer died in early September, and Will County, Illinois police report his family, looking through his home in northern Illinois, discovered more than 2,000 medically preserved fetuses. Four Republican state legislators called on Indiana Attorney General Curtis Hill to investigate whether any of the remains were illegally transported from Indiana. Hill and Illinois Attorney General Kwame Raoul are working jointly on the case.
And Delaney, there are a couple political issues at play that are here that I want to talk about, and I'll start with Pete Buttigieg. Some people have tried to tie, because Klopfer worked in South Bend, tried to tie this back to Pete Buttigieg. Is there any traction they can have there?
Look, this conduct by this doctor is so reprehensible that it's almost like out of a sci-fi movie. You know, you look at that and say, who would do something like that? And who would keep those remains, and why? And so some people react that way and say, okay, who do we blame? Okay, now, this, for all intents and purposes, this doctor operated over basically a three-year span in Gary, Fort Wayne, and South Bend.
Right.
Okay. For those who don't know, the mayor of South Bend does not regulate medical licensing or medical conduct. That is done by the Medical Licensing Board. And you know who appoints the Medical Licensing Board? The governor. You know who the governor was during that period of time?
Well, actually,
Mike Pence.
You know, revoked his medical license when he was governor?
Yeah, but not until after 3 years.
No, but I'll say this. Actually, what we found out today, at least the initial investigation has determined that the remains in Illinois are actually from a three-year period that's 2000 to 2002, which would be under
Frank O'Bannon.
So is it really state regulators who were to blame here?
Well, I don't know who you blame. Okay, other than a doctor who clearly, when he was alive, was unhinged doing something like he did. But I don't know that there's a crime that's occurred, number one. And number two, I don't know how you put that at the feet of the mayor of the city, who has absolutely no responsibility for issuing or continuing a medical license. Okay, Mike Pence ran around trying to close abortions facilities and trying to harass Planned Parenthood. And this was going on, maybe not the fetal remains that were transferred, but this guy was operating on Mike Pence's watch.
And was shut down during Mike
After
Pence's watch.
After 3 years.
During
yes.
Frank O'Bannon's term in office.
So look, the fact that the remains came from the early 2000s.
What I was going to say is it's a real stretch to hang this on Pete Buttigieg. Yet Ann doesn't waste any time hanging all manner of things that have nothing to do with Mike Pence on Mike Pence.
I mean,
it's all his
fault. Licensing
right?
board?
And so from an intellectual honesty standpoint, I do believe that there's too many moving parts here, and this is reprehensible activity, and it's going to be pinned on him and not some political, not on Mike Pence, not on Pete Buttigieg, and certainly not on Frank O'Bannon. But I hope we also remember in this, and this is what the pro-life community always misses in these, which is why there's little sympathy for the extremes, that the women who went through this and were in a situation they didn't want to be in, who had an abortion they never thought they'd be in the situation to want or have, are now kind of reliving this awful thing as well. And I hope that's kept in mind and talked about, too.
I want to make one point on that. There was a very good article on the fact that abortions now are down to less than half of what they were in 1990, not because of the ridiculous...
So the economy's strong.
Well, partly that, but also partly they think it's because of the availability under the ACA of contraception.
Yeah. Oh, and I've said it. We've
had that argument before. If you
well, we
if
haven't
you
argued with it. We haven't argued about it.
We agree. We agree. If you're pro-life, you have to be.
It's
got to
be a comprehensive
control policy.
I said there were two political issues
I wanted to ask about. We sort of dispensed with the Pete Buttigieg part of that. I want to ask about there is still an ongoing legal fight about the new abortion clinic in South Bend with the state not wanting to give him a license and courts forcing them to do so. Does this come into play with that, even though I'm not even sure there's a tangential relationship?
Well, there's no direct connection, certainly. And by the way, Pete Buttigieg was in high school. Not only does the mayor not have anything to do with it, but,
yeah,
but
he was in high school when
he was in high school during the three-year period
probably still his fault.
That you're talking about. He was thinking ahead, always a planner. And so there are those who will seek to pull this into that fray and use it as evidence of the overall practice being somehow flawed in terms of ethics and conduct. The odd thing, it seems to me, Illinois, this started sort of, the House was in Illinois, and the Illinois Attorney General's office was front and center on this, which plays a prosecutorial function. You're the former Illinois guy, not I. But a lot of states, that's in the way the criminal justice system is set up. Those are the prosecutors. My suggestion is, what is the Indiana Attorney General's office equipped to investigate something like this? It should be a state police matter.
Right.
Or if it's prosecuted, then it would go to. Well, I presume the county,
and
if
but
it's
he something, he already said he's
it makes,
in
to me it just seems an odd. It seems like an odd thing. Why we're not the. In fact, I think Illinois misunderstood what the function is of the Attorney General. We're going to work together to bring prosecution. Well, no, he's not.
Yeah.
He doesn't
have
that role.
The Attorney General of Illinois is to keep the Democrat Speaker out of prison.
All right, but I mean, as long as somebody tells him the AG doesn't file charges.
Who was his daughter? Yeah.
Curtis Hill, in speaking to the press today about this, acknowledged that. You know, they're going to push further to find out why this happened, how it happened, if anybody else was involved. But he acknowledged, we don't know that even technically if this had been found out when it happened, we don't know that there was any medical licensing standard that was violated or even any law that was violated. So is it possible that this is all just going to come down to, this was a weird, creepy, bad dude?
I mean, it's certainly possible that that's where we end up in this, and I think that's kind of what Attorney General Hill was getting at today, that they're really just starting the process of trying to figure this out, and it's a situation that no one has really dealt with before. Thankfully, no one has ever really dealt with it before. The one thing I noticed that he said that I thought was interesting, kind of to the political debate side of it, was that he said this is not an issue of being pro-life or pro-choice. This is just, you know, investigating the situation, you know, keeping in mind the women who are related to this situation and going from there. But I don't think that's how everyone's going to look at it. I mean, Senator Todd Young, for example, made a comment about how, you know, now is the time to push for, you know, pro-life activism measures, whatever it may be. So,
When we have a mass shooting, you can't talk about gun registration, but you can talk about this.
I'm not Todd Young.
Consistency.
When it's preventable,
The United Automobile Workers strike against General Motors, which includes thousands of workers in Indiana, has now run longer than the union's last strike in 2007. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Samantha Horton has more.
We are the union!
The UAW is pushing for a four-year contract that would give union workers higher wages and additional job protections at a time when the manufacturing industry is seeing reduced growth. Ball State economist Michael Hicks says any further economic slowdown, including the effects of the strike, will likely hit Indiana and other Rust Belt states harder than other parts of the country.
If this was 18 months ago or 24 months ago, this would be hardly noticeable to the U.S. economy. But for the Midwest, which is bearing almost the full brunt of the trade war right now, this is just a more painful experience.
He says even if the strike were to end soon, the impact will be felt well after.
John Schwanis, does this strike have a ripple effect into the political world?
If it ends tomorrow, no. If it ends maybe early next week, no. If it stretches on, you look at the dollars involved. The estimates are that the company itself is losing perhaps $100 million a day during this proposition, which boggles the mind. But perhaps more important in terms of visceral reaction on the part of the workforce and those sympathetic to the workforce across Indiana and across the country, certainly, would be the impact on those workers. And then where the ripple effect comes in, of course, is when those workers are not receiving paychecks and are shut down. Well, the suppliers, we've already seen layoffs among the suppliers that provide components in different parts that go into the assembly of these vehicles. And when they're not working because of their furloughed, nobody's buying the TVs, nobody's buying the appliances, nobody's buying the new wardrobe for the fall. And guess what then? That has an effect on the economy. Yeah. And the study I saw that I thought was interesting, because if anybody knows the auto industry, it's University of Michigan, which has in its business school a center devoted to the study of the intersection of the economy and the auto industry. And it says that if this stretches on, that the impact will be seven workers will be affected for every one striker. So if you do the math there, and we're talking 50,000 workers striking, that's a lot of people.
And so far on a political scale, we haven't really seen a lot of politicians weigh in publicly. As far as I know, J.D. Ford, a local state senator, said he was going to show support, but haven't really seen much on either side beyond that yet.
No, it's really interesting you bring that up, because I was kind of looking at that yesterday to see, okay, have politicians, and today to see, you know, who's tweeted about it, who's speaking out about it, and there's really not that much yet. I think, to his point, you know, if it does go on longer, then yes, I think we will start to see more of that, because this is all related to the economy, and the economy is definitely a political issue, so we could see more. But like you said, we saw a statement from State Senator J.D. Ford. I saw that Representative Andre Carson, you know, tweeted out support. You know, mostly I've seen some Democratic politicians tweeting out support, but other than that, haven't seen much.
Is this a place where, especially, I mean, when you think about not so much Indiana being a swing state in a year from now, but certainly Michigan will be, do you have to, if you're a politician on either side, but arguably more on the Republican side, do you have to be careful about how you talk about this
one? Oh, I think you do. Obviously, they've got a claim. I mean, they were there, and they helped GM when GM needed it, and now GM is reaping the profits from that, and they ought to be shared a little bit more equitably. So I think they've got a very good case to make. The problem is that we've already lost manufacturing jobs in Indiana, and we're very manufacturing and agricultural dependent, and the trade war for Trump and Pence is hurting Indiana. And this is going to compound the problem. And I'm seriously concerned, especially when you keep putting he keeps putting pressure on the Fed to cut interest rates. There just are not that many tools in the toolkit when the next recession hits.
Well, and Mike Hicks talked about that. If this were 18 months ago or 2 years ago, you wouldn't feel quite as nervous about the economic impacts of this thing. If you were advising a candidate for public office in Indiana or Michigan, where there are a lot of auto workers, what would you be telling them to say or not say right now?
Well, first of all, the 40% of the UAW members in 2016 voted for Trump, according to the UAW's own survey of their members.
Yeah.
Right. So there is support there, and there is a path of support there. I honestly couldn't, I can't predict what the trade, how the trade war is going to impact that. I think there's a blend of people that are like that Trump has finally gone after China,
and are willing to put up with
and are willing to suffer a little bit. I think we've seen that among you know, farmers in the agricultural community. I don't know how long they'll be willing to put up with it. Hopefully another 13 months.
And does this exacerbate that a little bit?
It does, and farm bankruptcies have gone up dramatically. So
but look,
those
I don't know, your average UAW member, I mean, there's a disconnect right now between the leadership of that organization and the rank and file anyway. The leaders are under federal investigation. The former president was just criticized for building a multi-million dollar home with non-union labor. So, I mean, there is a broad disconnect between how the union leaders are living and what they're telling and delivering for their members. And that's why I think a large number of them supported Donald Trump in 2016.
Well, we'll see if it happens in 2020.
We will. Yeah. Yeah, that's why we should have the election.
A report released this week says payday lenders drained over $300 million in financing charges from some of the poorest Hoosiers over the past 5 years.
The Indiana Institute for Working Families conducted the research. The group has advocated against payday lending legislation at the State House the last few years. Its report found most of Indiana's payday loan storefronts are in predominantly low-income neighborhoods. Institute Director Jessica Frazier says borrowers often get caught in a costly cycle of debt.
We know that 60% of Hoosiers take out another payday loan on the same day that they pay theirs off. We know that by a month out from the payday loan, it's about 80% have taken out another payday loan.
The state has a 36% interest rate cap on regular loans, but legislators carved out an exemption for payday loans. That means the rates for the short-term loans are even higher.
Lindsay, this issue will certainly come up again at the State House next session. We're talking about it during the summer period, too. How much of a factor will this report play, though?
Well, the Indiana Institute for Working Families is the one kind of behind this report. They're the ones that advocate for getting rid of payday loans at the State House. They're certainly going to be at the State House next year, so it will come up. I think the question is, you know, how much of an impact does it end up having? And that, I think, will be interesting to see because in last session, we had two bills. We had the one that would have capped payday loans at the 36%, and then we had another bill that would have created more short-term loan options at higher interest rates. And both came down to very close votes in the state Senate. And the one that would have capped the payday loans at 36% didn't make it out. The other one did make it over to the House, and then we saw it die in the House. So if the report can change a few lawmakers' minds, then it might have an impact.
It's single-digit votes, yeah.
I mean, but doesn't this also feel like something that the one side is going to use it because they think it helps them, and the other side will just say, well, ignore that and listen to us.
Yeah, well, I think, to Lindsay's point, it was the Institute and its pressure and some of the data it brought forth last session that derailed what appeared to be a bill that was on its way to the governor's desk. So, you know, and for those who seem preyed upon or feel preyed upon, it's good that the Institute is there because if you look at the median salary, according to the data, these are people who earn $19,000 a year. They're so busy trying to keep food on the table and the lights on, they're not going to be calling their elected officials or picketing. So it's an easy constituency to ignore.
And yet the data was already there, so this report adds to that a little bit. Do you see this as an issue that has changed over the last year when we go into next session, or is this another one where we're having the same debate over again?
Lawmakers hate this issue because they hate what these people don't earn a lot of money are going through, but what's never been presented is what's the option for people that can't get a loan from a bank? And that big number shows how big that need is.
Well, the option is to make it easier for the banks to do the short-term loans. That's sure. The option, because this is ridiculous.
Yeah, but that
it's
would put an industry out of business.
You know what? It ought to be out of business. When the effective annual rate for these payday loans is 360%, it's like a company store used to be in mining towns. People never get out from under. And a lot of the people that are using these payday loans are state employees who have been there for 10 or 15 years, still making $2,000 a month and can't support a family.
You've worked on this issue in the past. Do you feel a shift in which side is a little more weight to it?
Yeah, I think the 36% cap has certainly gotten more traction among Republican lawmakers. This vote is tight. Yeah. I've counted this vote before, and it is like 1, 2, 3 people. So this kind of stuff can flip it one way or the other.
All right. Well, that's Indiana Week in Review for this week. Our panel is Democrat Ann Delaney, Republican Mike O'Brien, John Schwannis of Indiana Lawmakers, and Lindsay Erdody of the Indianapolis Business Journal. If you'd like a podcast of this program, you can find it at wfyi.org/IWIR, or starting Monday, you can stream it or get it on demand from Xfinity and on the WFYI app. I'm Brandon Smith of Indiana Public Broadcasting. Join us next time, because a lot can happen in an Indiana week.
Indiana Week in Review is made possible by the supporters of Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations and by Ice Miller, built on a 100-plus-year foundation of legal service. Ice Miller is a full-service law firm committed to helping clients stay ahead of a changing world, working to develop an understanding of each client's needs to help build, grow, and protect their interests. More at icemiller.com. The opinions expressed are solely those of the panelists. Indiana Week in Review is a WFYI production in association with Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations.